File 13. I was even more disgusted at the way in which the same Vienna press salaamed obsequiously before the meanest steed belonging to the Habsburg royal equipage, and went off into wild ecstasies of delight if the nag wagged its tail in response. And at the same time, these newspapers took up an attitude of anxiety in matters that concern the German Emperor, trying to cloak their enmity by the serious air they gave themselves. But in my eyes, that enmity appeared to be only poorly cloaked. Naturally, they protested that they had no intention of mixing in Germany's internal affairs. God forbid! They pretended that by touching a delicate spot in such a friendly way, they were fulfilling a duty that devolved upon them by reason of the mutual alliance between the two countries, and at the same time discharging their obligations of journalistic truthfulness. Having thus excused themselves about tenderly touching a sore spot, they bored with the finger ruthlessly into the wound. That sort of thing made my blood boil. And now I began to be more and more on my guard when reading the great Vienna press. I had to acknowledge, however, that on such subjects one of the anti-Semitic papers, the Deutsche Volksblatt, acted more decently. What got still more on my nerves was the repugnant manner in which the big newspapers cultivated admiration for France. One really had to feel ashamed of being a German when confronted by those mellifluous hymns of praise for the great culture nation. This wretched gallomania more often than once made me throw away one of those world newspapers. I now often turned to the Volksblatt, which was much smaller in size, but which treated such subjects more decently. I was not in accord with its sharp anti-Semitic tone, but again and again I found that its arguments gave me grounds for serious thought. Anyhow, it was as a result of such reading that I came to know the man and the movement which then determined the fate of Vienna. These were Dr. Karl Luger and the Christian Socialist Movement. At the time I came to Vienna, I felt opposed to both. I looked on the man and the movement as reactionary. But even an elementary sense of justice enforced me to change my opinion when I had the opportunity of knowing the man and his work, and slowly that opinion grew into outspoken admiration when I had better grounds for forming a judgment. Today, as well as then, I hold Dr. Karl Luger as the most eminent type of German Bürgermeister. How many prejudices were thrown over through such a change in my attitude towards the Christian Socialist Movement. My ideas about anti-Semitism changed also in the course of time, but that was the change which I found most difficult. It cost me a greater internal conflict with myself, and it was only after a struggle between reason and sentiment that victory began to be decided in favor of the former. 2 years later, sentiment rallied to the side of reason and became a faithful guardian and counselor. At the time of this bitter struggle between calm reason and the sentiments in which I had been brought up, the lessons that I had learned on the streets of Vienna rendered me invaluable assistance. A time came when I no longer passed blindly along the street of the mighty city, as I had done in the early days, But now, with my eyes open not only to study the buildings, but also the human beings. Once, when passing through the inner city, I suddenly encountered the phenomenon in a long caftan and wearing black side locks. My first thought was, is this a Jew? They certainly did not have this appearance in Linz. I watched the man stealthily and cautiously, but the longer I gazed at the strange countenance and examined it feature by feature, the more the question shaped itself in my brain, is this a German? As was always my habit with such experiences, I turned to books for help in removing my doubts. For the first time in my life, I bought myself some anti-Semitic pamphlets for a few pence. But unfortunately, they all began with the assumption that in principle, the reader had at least a certain degree of information on the Jewish question, or was even familiar with it. Moreover, the tone of most of these pamphlets was such that I became doubtful again, because the statements made were partly superficial and the proofs extraordinarily unscientific. For weeks, and indeed for months, I returned to my old way of thinking. The subject appeared so enormous, and the accusations were so far-reaching, that I was afraid of dealing with it unjustly, and so I became again anxious and uncertain. Naturally, I could no longer doubt that here there was not a question of Germans who happened to be of a different religion, but rather that there was a question of an entirely different people. For as soon as I began to investigate the matter and observe the Jews, then Vienna appeared to me in a different light. Wherever I now went, I saw Jews. And the more I saw of them, the more strikingly and clearly they stood out as a different people from the other citizens, especially the inner city and the district northwards from the Danube Canal swarmed with a people who, even in outer appearance, bore no similarity to Germans. But any indecision which I may still have felt about the point was finally removed by the activities of a certain section of the Jews themselves. A great movement called Zionism arose among them. Its aim was to assert the national character of Judaism, and the movement was strongly represented in Vienna. To outward appearance, it seemed as if only one group of Jews championed this movement, while the great majority disapproved of it, or even repudiated it. But an investigation of the situation showed that those outward appearances were purposely misleading. These outward appearances emerged from a mist of theories which had been produced for reasons of expediency, if not for purposes of downright deception. For that part of Jewry which was styled liberal, did not disown the Zionists as if they were not members of their race, but rather as brother Jews, who publicly professed their faith in an unpractical way so as to create a danger for Jewry itself. Thus, there was no real rift in their internal solidarity. This fictitious conflict between the Zionists and the liberal Jews soon disgusted me, for it was false through and through, and in direct contradiction to the moral dignity and immaculate character on which that race had always prided itself. Cleanliness, whether moral or of another kind, had its own peculiar meaning for these people. That they were water-shy was obvious on looking at them, and unfortunately, very often also, were not looking at them at all. The odour of these people in caftans often used to make me feel ill. Beyond that were the unkempt clothes and the ignoble exterior. All these details were certainly not attractive, but the revolting feature was that beneath their unclean exterior, one suddenly perceived the moral mildew of the chosen race. What soon gave me cause for very serious consideration were the activities of the Jews in certain branches of life, into the mystery of which I penetrated little by little. Was there any shady undertaking, any form of foulness, especially in cultural life, in which at least one Jew did not participate? On putting the probing knife carefully in that kind of abscess, one immediately discovered, like a maggot in a putrescent body, a little Jew who was often blinded by the sudden light. In my eyes, the charge against Judaism became a grave one the moment I discovered the Jewish activities in the press, in art, in literature, and the theatre. All anxious protests were now more or less futile. One needed only to look at the posters announcing the hideous productions of the cinema and theatre, and study the names of the authors who were highly lauded there, in order to become permanently adamant on Jewish questions. Here was a pestilence, a moral pestilence, with which the public was being infected. It was worse than the Black Plague of long ago. And in what mighty doses this poison was manufactured and distributed. Naturally, the lower the moral and intellectual level of such an author of artistic products, the more inexhaustible his fecundity. Sometimes it went so far that one of these fellows, acting like a sewage pump, would shoot his filth directly in the face of other members of the human race. In this connection, we must remember there is no limit to the number of such people. One ought to realize that, for one. Goethe. Nature may bring into existence 10,000 such despoilers who act as the worst kind of germ carriers in poisoning human souls. It was a terrible thought, and yet it could not be avoided that the greater number of the Jews seemed specially destined by nature to play this shameful part. And is it for this reason that they can be called the chosen people? I began then to investigate carefully the names of all the fabricators of these unclean products in public cultural life. The result of that inquiry was still more disfavorable to the attitude which I had hitherto held in regard to the Jews. Though my feelings might rebel 1,000 times, reason now had to draw its own conclusions. The fact that 9/10 of all the smutty literature, artistic tripe and theatrical banalities had to be charged to the account of people who formed scarcely 1% of the nation, that fact could not be gainsaid. It was there and had to be admitted. Then I began to examine my favorite world press with that fact before my mind. The deeper my soundings went, the lesser grew my respect for that press which I formerly admired. Its style became still more repellent, and I was forced to reject its ideas as entirely shallow and superficial. To claim that in the presentation of facts and views its attitude was impartial seem to me to contain more falsehood than truth. The writers were Jews. Thousands of details that I had scarcely noticed before seemed to me now to deserve attention. I began to grasp and understand things which I had formerly looked at in a different light. I saw the liberal policy of that press in another light, its dignified tone in replying to the attacks of its adversaries, and its dead silence in other cases, now became clear to me as part of a cunning and despicable way of deceiving the readers. Its brilliant theatrical criticisms always praised the Jewish authors, and its adverse criticism was reserved exclusively for the Germans. The light pinpricks against William II showed the persistency of its policy, just as did its systematic commendation of French culture and civilization. The subject matter of the feuilleton was trivial and often pornographic. The language of this press as a whole had the accent of a foreign people. The general tone was openly derogatory to the Germans, and this must have been definitely intentional. What were the interests that urged the Vienna press to adopt such a policy? Or did they do so merely by chance? In attempting to find an answer to those questions, I gradually became more and more dubious. Then, something happened which helped me to come to an early decision. I began to see through the meaning of a whole series of events that were taking place in other branches of Viennese life. All these were inspired by a general concept of manners and morals which was openly put into practice by a large section of the Jews and could be established as attributable to them. Here again, the life which I observed on the streets taught me what evil really is.